Many South Dakotans grew up thinking there are boys and there are girls. We talk about the complexities of gender. From SDPB Radio, it's Tuesday, March 16th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, debate in the State House over House Bill 1217 found lawmakers talking about the superiority of male athletes, what it means to have a masculine body, and the notion of biological sex. Today, we'll hear some of that testimony, and we seek to clarify terms and definitions. What language do we use to talk about transgender people? What are the questions you are afraid to ask? Plus, we preview Dakota Wesleyan's Stark Lecture by welcoming the Reverend Dr. Sean Moore to the program. We'll talk race and reconciliation. That's coming later in the hour. News is first. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. South Dakota Department of Health officials have dropped the rate of community spread of the coronavirus from substantial to moderate in Pennington County. That includes the Rapid City area. The county's spread had been classified as substantial, which is the highest level since May of 2020. There have been more than 13,000 positive tests in the county, including two in the latest report. Health officials report 26 new COVID-19 cases statewide for about 114,000 positive tests since the start of the pandemic. The number of deaths remained unchanged at 1,912. Hospitalizations stayed the same for the second straight day at 64. After a delay due to COVID-19, the community of Gregory is getting a new hospital, clinic, and long-term care center. SDPB's Kyle Ireland reports.
The $36 million project will integrate a 17-bed hospital, 30-bed long-term care center, and a clinic that will accommodate up to 10 local providers and visiting outreach specialists. The new hospital will operate as a single campus on roughly 20 acres of land. Tony Tamanis is the CEO of Vera Gregory Hospital. He says the new facility will double their current space and accommodate the latest technology and evidence-based medical practices. He says it's cost-effective to build new because simply updating the current facility would cost more than $10 million.
On that bill, we said, you know, maybe it's time to start looking at not just a replacement, but an actual a new build in our community. And that was the start of the whole process.
Tamanis says a new facility will focus on the changing needs in healthcare. It will include connections to telemedicine services, a helipad, and a larger surgical suite. He says more care is done on an outpatient basis than in years past. Gregory's hospital sees 13,000 outpatients per year compared to less than 600 inpatient visits.
But we're a small rural community in South Central South Dakota, but we punch well above our weight as far as volume. We see between 12 and 15 thousand patients per year.
Tamanis says having a modern facility to match its recognized quality of care will help with physician and employee recruitment and retention. Groundbreaking is planned for late April. The long-term care center is expected to be complete in the summer of 2022 and the hospital and clinic in the fall of 2023. Reporting for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
For weather today, we're seeing mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of drizzle, snow, and freezing drizzle in the west this afternoon. Around the same time in the northeast, patchy drizzle. A slight chance of rain for the southeast today. Expected highs are in the lower 30s to the lower 40s statewide. Later tonight, clouds will continue with a chance of snow in the west closer to midnight. Snow is likely in the southeast beginning this evening, which could possibly mix with rain over the night. In the northeast, some patchy fog with a slight chance of snow as well. Evening lows in the upper teens to the lower 30s. Looking ahead to tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies statewide, but gradually becoming sunny in the west. Chance of snow there as well, with patchy fog in the northeast just before the afternoon. Wednesday's highs are in the upper 30s to the mid 40s. Coming up next, it's In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Pianist Chick Corea, who died last month, won two Grammy Awards on Sunday. The other big jazz winner was composer Maria Schneider, who also took home a pair of trophies. I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear Corea and Schneider's Grammy-winning music, along with other recipients of Jazz Grammy Gold, vocalist Kurt Elling, bandleader composer Arturo O'Farrell, and pianist arranger John Beasley. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Missouri River Energy Services, working in partnership with our 61 member communities to provide energy and energy services that support citizens and help sustain local business. MRenergy.com.
This week in This American Life. For a long time, people have said the SATs are biased against certain groups of kids and we should not require them. And then, this year, because of the pandemic, most of the top colleges stopped.
My mom was the first person I told. So I ran to her, gave her a hug, we like jumped.
Who wins and who loses as the pandemic throws college admissions into chaos this week.
Listen Saturday morning at 11 Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support and by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly with Gene Hufford Agency Incorporated. GeneHufford.com.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today we're going to talk about gender and sex. House Bill 1217 is currently awaiting Governor Kristi Noem's signature. She has said previously she was excited to sign the legislation, but also emphasized that all bills go through a rigorous review before she signs them into law. House Bill 1217 is positioned as a bill that promotes continued fairness in women's sports, with rules directed toward transgender students. Specifically, it would ban transgender girls from playing on sports teams with their peers. In a few moments, we'll bring you audio from the debate on the House floor, but first we need to clarify some terms, definitions, and understandings. In the audio you'll hear in a few moments, lawmakers refer to biological males and masculine bodies, and at least one lawmaker asserts there are, quote, two sexes in the world, there are boys and there are girls, end quote. So before we play that audio, we have invited certified gender specialist Ann Dillon Schneider to join us for clarity and accuracy. Ann, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Oh, good morning, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Now, we have put up on our website, sdpb.org, a list of definitions and sort of a, you know, frequently asked question. And one of the things I've found, Anne, and maybe this is true for you, that even people who are, amenable to persuasion about understanding human gender expression will lower their voices and sort of whisper a question to me and say, what about this? They're embarrassed of some of their questions. Talk a little bit as we begin here about just destigmatizing the conversation, but doing it in a way that does not make transgender people feel targeted or frightened. What are some of the ways to sort of begin learning about something that most of us weren't taught growing up?
Well, and part of it is, I think a lot of the information when we were growing up really wasn't public. We know so much more now after over 50 years of research. So we know that sex and gender are pretty complicated, as I know you know, because sex is what we say someone's body is when they're born. We say, oh, is it, what a great way to start, right? Is it a boy or a girl? And sometimes you can tell, but sometimes actually you can't. So it's not even body sex isn't clear. And then gender has to do with DNA and hormones and all kinds of things and the brain. And we can't tell that without asking what somebody's gender is. And we can talk about how those happen. But when it comes to making people safe, just like everything, you know, we don't assume someone is married, right? So we usually introduce ourselves. And so often, you know, I will say, my name is Anne, and I'll say my pronouns. And my pronouns are she and her. So someone knows, okay, that's the appropriate name, you know, because some people call me Annie with an E because it has an E, and that actually isn't my name. So they know how to pronounce my name, right? And then which pronouns to use. And then that makes it safe for the other person to say, oh, my name is Jill and my pronouns are they, or my name is Sam and my pronouns are he. So that way already, if I introduce that at the beginning, what the appropriate name I want to be called is and the appropriate pronouns, it already sets it as a safer environment. to begin to have a conversation about a pretty complicated topic that we always get a little embarrassed talking about things related to the body in general.
And when you say we can't tell without asking what someone's gender is, I want you to expand on that a little bit, because what you're saying there is someone could come into the room, look like what you think a woman looks like, talk like what you think a woman talks like, have a name that is a female name, have a female voice, and you could get a they pronoun. Tell me a little bit more about why that would be for somebody who you think you have found a category in your brain for, suddenly saying to you, no, that's not quite the complete picture of who I am.
Right. So first of all, we love categories, right? It makes us feel so much safer. We can say, this is this and this is that. I mean, even we do it in politics. This is a Democrat. This is a Republican. Well, it's a lot more nuanced than that, right? We're in many places on that spectrum in our conversations, and people may be more conservative or liberal depending on what the topic is. So we're actually used to having a spectrum of where we actually are. When it comes to sex and gender, you know, like I said, sex, we kind of assume that at birth based on looking at the child's genitals. And like I said, you know, most of the time you can tell, but not always. So about 5.5 million people in the United States, when they were born, we couldn't tell if they were a girl or a boy. And that's probably about 15,000 people in South Dakota. Now, we don't ask people that, okay? If I met you somewhere, I'm not going to say, so what are your genitals, right? That would be very rude. So I kind of make an assumption about your body, but then I'm not really sure about your gender. We tend to assume that the person's gender matches their body sex. But that doesn't always match up, because what happens is when a baby's growing, in the first trimester, mom's pregnant, baby's growing, the first trimester, the body is a hormone wash that sets the sex of the body, somewhere male, female, or sometimes a little more intersex is what we would say. But that's the first trimester. The brain and gender, okay, get determined in the second trimester, not at the same time. And it has to do with the mom's uterine environment. It has to do with the way the baby responds to hormones. It has to do with DNA signaling, miles of DNA within at least 12 genes. And that's, and that second wash happens in the second trimester, so months 4 to 6, that's when the brain gender is set. So often they match, for most people, close enough. The gender and the brain gender, right, and, which is internal, and the body sex match. This is a gross oversimplification, but it's pretty close.
Right.
But if they don't match, I was explaining it to someone the other day. It's like, you know, when you're stacking Lego bricks, they usually match, right? Right on top. But if you're one off, they don't quite match. And so we have people who, when they're born, their brain gender may be female, but their body may be male. Okay, or they may be, you know, somewhere in the middle. So we actually don't know somebody's gender without asking them. And the simplest way to ask is name and pronouns. But we can't assume that about people. Biology is very diverse. And so it's kind of like any condition. Like I was talking with somebody about, like if a child is born with a cleft palate, okay, that's something that happens in utero, right? When the child's born, you'll say, oh, yeah, you've got a cleft palate. You can't suck really well. You can't nurse well. We're not going to do anything. We'll just let you die. We don't do that. We never do that. You know, the good thing is that we have people who are trained in surgery and medicine and science, and we know how to fix that condition, right? Same thing when someone is transgender. When things don't match and they are distressed because they're not, we have scientists and medical people and researchers who know how to fix that. And so it's similar kind of things. Sometimes things go a little different than we think they should when people are developing before they're born.
So some of the audio we're going to hear in a minute as lawmakers talk about this will have terms like biological males or masculine bodies. Is there any such thing as a biological male or a biological female? What is the best way to have that conversation when it comes to how we refer to people who are born in what we recognize as male?
So we have some people who are assigned male at birth. Okay, we assume their sex and we're assuming their gender. So their body and their brain, we're assuming that. So it's assigned male at birth. And we have other people who are assigned female at birth based on what we see. And it's just assigned. These are assumptions. We don't actually know. When we won't know until the person is older. Okay, so for instance, like when a child is intersex, when we can't tell if they're a girl or a boy, horrifically, they used to chop off body parts. They don't do that anymore because they found they made mistakes. So now best practice for decades has been we wait till the person tells us who they are because we don't know. And that's really true of all of us.
Are people choosing their own gender?
No, I would say fundamentally not. I think we have a sense of who we are. And when someone is seeking assistance, there is a whole process that people go through that involves an entire medical team and many assessments and agreement with children. Of course, it involves parents. Well, we all have a variety of gender expression. You know, I may wear a dress one day. And I may wear jeans another day. 100 years ago, if you were a woman in South Dakota, you would never, ever wear pants. You were sure you would go to hell, okay? Even in the middle of a blizzard or the storm like we had this week, right? You'd be out there in your long skirt trying to navigate all that, which seems crazy to us. But at the time, gender expression for females did not allow the wearing of pants because then you would be like a man, okay? So gender expression, we're all over the map on that. But when it comes to actual gender, people aren't making it up. And when it comes to treatment, we have 120 pages of standards of care that we follow to determine what's happening with somebody and to help them be their best self.
So for clarity for people, you know, when we were discussing transgender locker rooms and bathroom bills, one of the concerns some lawmakers had would be that somebody could just simply say, you know, here I am living in a male body and now I have decided to put on a dress, call myself a girl and walk into the female bathroom and, you know, engage in some predatory behavior. And so expand on what we were saying before about there has to be some kind of diagnosis. It's not just about putting on a gender expression, you know, item of clothing and then saying today I will be this and tomorrow I will be something else.
Right, exactly. When we come to gender, I mean, gender expression, sure, I may dress one way or the other, but when it comes to things like bathrooms and all that, first of all, people need to realize that bathrooms are not the unsafe place. I mean, we know from awful stories from coaches and other people who have abused children, it's not the bathroom that's the problem. And most people just want to be safe in the bathroom. But for places like schools and sports, even anywhere, we actually have policies where people have to have in place, you know, this is who I am. This is who my medical team agrees that I am. This is who my parents agree that I am. And people have gone through hours and hours and hours of assessment and documentation, even to get to the point of name changing. Okay. So it's not like, it's not a, hi, today, this is what I'm going to be. That's just not how that works. I mean, it's a medical condition. 195 countries have agreed it's a medical condition, and next year are coding that insurance companies and, you know, medical providers will start moving toward using medical coding for gender incongruence when gender and sex don't match. So this is a recognized medical condition. It's not just something people are making up in their minds.
I want to talk a little bit about this sports bill, because the testimony that we'll hear in a few minutes has a lot to do with girls getting hurt or girls getting, you know, losing out on scholarships, losing out on championships because there is a transgender girl or what lawmakers will refer to as a biological male competing against them. Talk to me about transgender girls, because that's specifically who the bill is referring to, playing on a sports team. What is a deeper way of thinking about that individual girl or young woman and what her needs are to play in a group of peers?
Mm-hmm. So if somebody is female, but their body looks male, usually they've actually been having medical treatment. And remember, we have a really carefully written high school sports policy. Okay, it's been in effect for 8 years. And when they came up with that policy, they looked at all the policies in the United States, and they worked for years on it. And it's actually working very well. So a child who identifies as a girl but may have been assigned male at birth, usually during puberty, they've been on what's called puberty blockers. And what that does is it prevents the testosterone from building up in their body. So they don't have muscles. They don't have typical male puberty growth. And then by the time they hit about 16, they would then go on estrogen and a testosterone blocker. So again, we're not talking about girls with lots of testosterone in their body. And when a child is playing on a girls' team and they are transgender in our state, there's medical documentation, parent documentation, that has to be provided about the child's treatment and all that. So this is not a bunch of boys who suddenly one day were full of testosterone, one day said, I'm going to play on the girls' team. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really big misunderstanding. Because if anything, have less testosterone. So these kids are all in medical treatment, and they just want to play on the team that they identify with. And we know that sports and teamwork are lifesavers. What keeps kids from committing suicide is being part of a group. We know that when kids are isolated, they commit suicide. And these kids have a 60% suicide attempt rate. That's not thinking about it. Okay, this is a 60% suicide attempt rate. And so one of the things we know, and Governor Cox of Utah pointed this out, is that sports save lives. Kids who can play on sports teams have a group that they can bond with and be part of. And it's so important for teenage development. And yet we are denying these girls, and they are girls, a chance to participate in that, and we further isolate them. And that's not good medical or social practice.
So here's what we have for listeners. Ann Dillon Schneider has written a blog post for us about gender and sex with terminologies, and you can find that on our website at sdpb.org. You can also find there an episode of On Call with the Prairie Doc talking about transgender kids and transgender adults in South Dakota and beyond. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk with members of the Sioux Falls Sports Authority, and we're also going to look at nationwide some of this model legislation and how this conversation is unfolding across the country. So we'll hear lawmakers debate House Bill 1217 coming up next. Ann Dillon Schneider is a certified gender specialist. Ann, thank you so much for this. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks, Lori, for just making sure that we all get involved in the conversation. And it's a wider conversation than in peer. It just really helps us understand each other and be really a more gentle and accepting state, really, because the people of South Dakota are truly amazing in their hospitality, and we want to be known as those people. So thank you for helping us be a little more recognized as that, for who we really are.
Thank you, Ann. Up next, you're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Mexico is on the verge of legalizing marijuana. It will become the world's largest market for legal pot. So how will that affect the drug cartels that operate inside the country? Also, more journalists are dying on the job around the world. We'll ask why next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Statehouse coverage provided by Boyce Law Firm. Committed to our clients and building lasting relationships. A broad scope of services, from personal injury to commercial disputes. Expertise you can rely on. Experience, integrity, community. BoyceLaw.com.
Beginning March 29th, weekday mornings on SDPB will sound a little different. Starting at 9, 8 Mountain with 2 hours of 1A, followed by On Point at 11, 10 Mountain. Then join the team from In the Moment as we cover stories about South Dakota, told by the people from South Dakota. It's all your favorite shows, but at new times, starting March 29th on SDPB. Take In the Moment with you wherever you go with the In the Moment podcast. New episodes drop every Friday and feature the best of the week from news and the arts. Download and subscribe to In the Moment wherever you get your podcasts. In Their Own Words brings you closer to the debates and conversations behind legislative topics. It's supported by SDN Communications.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. For today's In Their Own Words, as part of our look at House Bill 1217, we're going to take you back to February, to the first day of testimony about women's sports and the impact of transgender athletes on the House floor. A note to listeners, you will hear language here that includes inaccurate descriptions of transgender people.
House Bill 1217, an act to promote continued fairness in women's sports.
House Bill 1217, having had its second reading, is now for consideration and final passage. Representative Milstead.
Mr. Speaker, fellow House members, I had the privilege on Tuesday to hear testimony from 9 female athletes, from 2 female family members of athletes, and 1 father of a female athlete, who were part of a growing community of parents, grandparents, and more, not only in our state, but in our nation, asking for fairness as well as safety for girls who want to participate in sports. Today, sport is identified as a universally shared human culture. It refreshes our body and our mind and helps us maintain a healthy lifestyle. In 1972, because of the efforts of the American Civil Liberties Union, along with a judge who recognized that males have physical advantages over females, and therefore schools had valid reasons to keep athletic competitions separated by sex, Congress enacted Title IX, leading to new opportunities for female athletes on their own teams and in their own individual sports. Because of Title IX, women have fought hard for the opportunity to compete and to be taken seriously as athletes. So what's changed? Boys, males are now being allowed to participate in female-specific sports, even in the state of South Dakota. Not in 2020 because of COVID, but as recently as 2019. What has not changed is that there continues to be a 10 to 50% gap between males and females at puberty in muscle mass and strength, including increased heart size, hemoglobin levels, and different muscle types and fat-to-muscle ratios. Looking at state high school records in track and field show that there are significant differences in girls' events and boys' events, differences that measure in feet, not inches. Boys throw faster, run faster, hit longer, jump higher, lift heavier, kick farther, swim faster, and run longer. Basketballs are smaller for women, hurdles are lower, tee boxes are closer to the pin, softballs are smaller. The only way for the playing field to be fair and level is to let biological females play against biological females. Then their competitiveness will be based solely on how hard they train. I ask you to support the female athletes in your life, as well as the ones who have gone before, wanting to compete for a chance at excellence in fair female sports. And please push that green button. Thank you.
Further remarks regarding House Bill 1217, Representative Soy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. For a specific example where this is happening, we received the testimony of 3 female track athletes in Connecticut who have been forced to compete against biological males and have lost out on state competitions and scholarship opportunities. Here's just a few excerpts from what they shared. In 2017, 2 biological male athletes won 15 women's state championship titles in track and field, titles that were previously held by 9 different girls in 2016. In the year previous, those 2 biological males had participated in boys' track, and they moved over to compete in women's track the next year. I worry how many college recruiters who only have a limited number of scholarships and slots on college track teams to award will skip over the names of other female athletes and only look at the name at the top of those results, a name that belongs to a biological male athlete. Now, I'm sure you will hear as an argument in opposition that, well, this isn't happening in South Dakota, okay? We see it some other places, but that's just not true. We have specific examples of shot put, track, basketball, where biological males are competing and they are winning the awards and taking the place of female athletes. So with all that, I would ask you to please support this bill and to save women's sports.
For the remarks, Representative Hoffman.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. And I agree with the previous speaker times two. When we, you know, go back in history a little bit, this has been fought. But as only Yogi Berra would say, Title IX only matters when it doesn't. And having two granddaughters, and I had two daughters, and they played normal sports, but I can't think of anything more offensive than having a masculine body of a male birth playing against my daughters, my granddaughters, in sports. And the only time I've really, in junior high and swimming, the girls, many times, because they develop a little faster before puberty or during puberty, the men or the boys don't, but they'll beat the boys in swimming. And if you want to see a seventh grade boy cry, have them watch a girl beat them. There's no difference in having a boy play against the girls and beating them. And I really feel badly for them. But in all reality, I don't even want to go into any labeling of anyone. I just, there's two sexes in the world. There's two chromosomes. There's an X, there's an XY, and there's boys and there's girls. And when we play in our sports in this state, I think we have to maintain a vigil that my two granddaughters someday don't have to play against testosterone-laden boys in high school sports.
Thank you for the remarks, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a couple of questions for the prime sponsor.
State your question.
So my first question, I see that an athletic team has to be defined as male, female, or co-ed. Would anything prevent all teams from being listed as co-ed?
Representative Milstead, would you like to answer that question?
I'm going to say nothing would prevent that, but why would you want that? We want to be recognized for what we do. We want to be challenged equally as males, as females. Co-ed teams are for fun.
Representative Olson.
Okay, thank you. I think to that point, I think sometimes when people are looking at the unintended consequences of what we do, if we pass a bill like this and the workaround is to label all teams as co-ed, then you've circumvented the intent of this bill. I think I want to make a couple of comments about, we talked about this bill last year. It was broader scope, but it's the same issue. And so we want to look at it on the flip side. We've talked a lot about boys not being able to play in girls' sports, but Texas passed this law, and they had unintended consequences. So they passed this and said, you have to play in the sport of your birth certificate. And they had a girl who was transitioning to be a boy, and she was doing wrestling. And because that law was in place, and it wasn't left up to the athletic association or the schools, she was a pretty large girl, very strong, taking hormones because she was transitioning to be a boy. She wanted to wrestle with the boys. They would not let her. The law forbid it. And she hurt those girls. And there was no recourse. She wanted to play with the boys. The parents of the girls wanted her to play with the boys. And there was no recourse because there was a law. So we have to think about that. When we pass these, and this bill says that they can't take hormonal treatment. So now we're saying people who are choosing that path, even if you don't disagree with it, cannot take their medications that they want to take or play sports. So they either have to transition or not play sports. And I would urge you not to pass this bill. I think if we want to look at this, let's let the athletic association deal with it. Let's let the local schools deal with this. But if you pass this bill and you say that sports are by birth certificate, you are also harming girls' sports because Texas did that and we know that as precedent. Thank you.
Further remarks, Representative Ms. Givens.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is just for a little bit of perspective. For all my adult lifetime, we've talked about female power, and it's nice to finally see the female representatives in this room acknowledge the male superiority. So thank you all very much. Is it true or not? Okay, moving forward. This issue doesn't impact very many individuals, and we've heard that said on the floor. And a number that I've heard is that of 95,000 students participating in sports in South Dakota, this has happened one time. It may be three. So if that number's off by a small amount, that percentage is minuscule over a long period of time. So I want you to keep that in consideration. This is a moral issue. Most of us are not going to change our minds. I would contend, however, that while the number of males or male-born individuals participating in sports in South Dakota is very low, the numbers of females participating in male sports is much higher. A boy lost his opportunity to be the kicker for the state championship football team here in Pierre last year because he was out-kicked by a young lady on the team. On wrestling teams from this state, we have a number of young ladies participating in male sports, and next year they will have female opportunities in their own sport for high school competitive female wrestling. But last year, on a historical perspective, this bill, or one very similar to it, couldn't be passed out of committee because we had one member missing. We tied on multiple votes, 6-6. We sent it to the floor without recommendation. We sent it to the floor in multiple votes. We tied 44 all with two members missing. So this is a moral issue, and I just ask for respect among all members. And I do believe personally that the Activities Association takes each case under advisement. If the girls in that sport are put at physical harm or risk, that individual is not allowed to participate in female sports. So I think a full discussion of the issue is valid in this instance. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks, Representative Duba.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I want to remind the body that we're all about local control. And in this case, South Dakota High School Activities, who've set the rules for high school sports for as far back as I can remember, and I am a part of Title IX, by the way, they have a solid policy that was approved by over 85% of the member schools and continues to be a solid policy. We don't see, and we didn't see in that testimony, schools coming to the foreground saying it's not fair, we lost championships, we lost this, we lost that. But I think we're really losing sight of the big picture here. One of the things we need to remember is trans kids are children, they're humans. To first of all make that leap to determine that you are willing to be who you are and work through that process mentally, not just physically, is one of the most difficult things that a young child can go through. And here we're talking about the mad invasion of trans people, and they're all going to take over women's sports. I don't think that's going to happen. I'm willing to bet my life on that. But more importantly, I think we lose sight of the fact that these children want to be fit in. They want to be a part of a group. Now, if they wanted to be in the choir, would we be concerned about that? If they wanted to be in drama, would we be concerned about that? No, we are focusing on one tiny, small aspect of their high school years. And it's hard enough to get through high school now. It's hard today to be a child, a high school kid, and then we're going to say, you can't compete. And we're making it sound as if every one of these children is some supernova. I would urge you to remember that these are children. I don't see hundreds of children and coaches running to the Capitol telling us we need to legislate something that belongs with the High School Activities Association, and I would encourage a no vote. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks, Representative Healy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, today we are being asked to vote for a bill protecting girls from their classmates, their teammates, and their friends who might be transgender children. Have we heard a call from students to do that? No. Have we heard from any school personnel about the need for this? No. Have we heard from any real examples of transgender girls in our state actually dominating competitions? No. Have we heard from athletic directors? No. Have we heard from college and universities who have compliance offices for Title IX? No, not a single one was here. Have we heard how many trans athletes are participating in South Dakota High School Association and activities at this time in South Dakota? The answer is zero. Instead, we've heard stories from one state on the east side from plaintiffs that are currently in litigation. We've been told that if they allow transgender kids to play with their peers, which has been allowed in South Dakota since 2013, that girls' sports will cease to exist. And that is simply so untrue. Girls' sports will continue to exist and thrive with transgender girls playing as they have nearly done for a whole decade in our state. Our legislature has rejected bills like this 6 times, and this is the 7th attempt that we have seen to prevent transgender kids from playing sports with their peers. It's harmful, it's hurtful, and it's discriminatory. I have personally heard from transgender kids and their parents, and they have told me how frightened they feel, how targeted they are, and how this bill makes them feel like they do not belong in the state of South Dakota. And I can't say this more, they do belong here. As a cisgender woman, I resent the suggestion that this bill should pass in my name and in the name of girls and women like me. And I'm not the only one, and I know you guys are so incredibly used to my research because I did some research on who else supports girls, trans girls participating in these organizations. And the list of organizations I found are committed to women's rights and gender justice and support the full inclusion of transgender girls and people in athletics. These organizations have a long history of advocating for fairness in sports and opportunities for all women to benefit from athletic participation and competition. These organizations care deeply about ending sex-based discrimination and ensuring access for athletics for all women and girls. And some of these include American Association of University Women, Girls Inc., National Women's Law Center, Women's Sports Foundation, and even the YWCA. They all support the inclusion of trans girls in sports. People have the right to be concerned about sex discrimination in sports. We will only accomplish equal opportunity for all women and girls and transgender girls if we approach this with fairness and respect. And what I really hope to get through to you today is if we continue to focus on legislation like this, we're only going to continue to hurt our trans youth. I urge you to oppose this bill and to support all girls in sports. Thank you.
Thank you. The question before the body is final passage of House Bill 1217. All those in favor will vote yay. Those opposed, nay. Madam Clerk, please unlock the voting machine. Would the members proceed to vote?
Mr. Speaker, there were ayes 50, nays 17, excuse 3.
House Bill 1217, having received a vote of the majority of the members elect, is hereby declared passed.
House Bill 1217 then moved to the Senate, and after testimony on the State Affairs Committee on a vote of 6-3, the bill was defeated. But then it was called out of committee in a procedural move called a smokeout. The bill now awaits Governor Kristi Noem's signature. You can hear the complete hearing testimony at sd.net. Follow the SD Legislature link in the meetings archives section. We'll talk more about House Bill 1217 on tomorrow's In the Moment. We'll discuss efforts to enact similar legislation in other states, and we'll look at what the bill could mean for tournaments in South Dakota. We talk race and reconciliation next. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
All across the internet, a game of whack-a-mole is being played. Far-right extremists are moving quickly from one platform to the next as big tech removes their right to post content.
We're hanging on for dear life, and we're going to survive off the platforms. We're entering a totally new chapter in the movement and on the internet as a whole.
Extremism in the virtual space, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
SDPB brings you the South Dakota Boys State Basketball Tournament.
You can watch all the action Thursday, March 18th through Saturday, March 20th. For more information, including multiple ways to watch the games live, go to sdpb.org/basketball. Complete coverage of the South Dakota Boys State Basketball Tournament brought to you by Dakota Bank and SD Corps.
Join your friends and neighbors who keep SDPB strong, become a $5 a month sustaining member, and gain access to a library of hundreds of shows with SDPB Passport. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The Reverend Dr. Sean Moore was a police officer in the Twin Cities for 10 years as senior pastor of Living Spirit United Methodist Church in Minneapolis and an instructor of Reconciliation Studies at Bethel University and Criminal Justice and Diversity at Metropolitan State University. He continues to work with law enforcement officials in the area of implicit bias training. Moore gives the Dakota Wesleyan University Stark Lecture via live stream. You can go to www.dwu.edu/live. It's this Thursday night at 7 p.m. Central. And Reverend Dr. Sean Moore is with us for a preview. Dr. Moore, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. What a lovely introduction. So that's great. Thanks.
Tell me a little bit about what your neighborhood and your church community, your faith community, has been going through since the death of the killing of George Floyd in police custody to today when the trial and the legal process continues to unfold. What has life been like in your neighborhood during this time?
Well, I think there's this two-part, or maybe three-part, kind of swirling together of there being hope for justice. Then there's this idea that can we see justice be done? And there's still this lamenting versus anger. And so lamenting, I would say, is a more of a focused response to the harm, and anger is more of a kind of reaction. And so we have all of these going on in the neighborhood at the very same time. And so it's kind of important to, as we look to doing pastoral care for those that are in the church, it might look different for those that are outside in the neighborhood. So it's consistently juggling the bowls and doing so well.
Yeah. Talk about that lamentation and the grief, the weight of it, because what so many of us who don't live in the community of Minneapolis realized after the video was circulated of George Floyd's death was how much weight existed nationwide that caused these nationwide protests, and there was so much heaviness already. So talk about that heaviness and what you're seeing from people. Specifically, I'm curious what you think the role of the church is in that.
Gotcha. So let's start off with the heaviness. I think when you started seeing all these things kind of erupt and explode throughout the nation, it was almost as if one more time, it's like, how many more times do people have to say and share and engage in, I guess it's the narrative of oppression in this country. And I think that we need to take a look at that, because this isn't something that's new. It's very old. You've got the Watts riot. You've got the Highway 94 that went through here in the Rondo neighborhood. You've got there are multiple places in the nation where these things take place, and then months afterwards, it just kind of settles down again. And so I think we need to engage in the practice of reconciliation. And this is where I think the church plays a pivotal role, right? And so as followers of Jesus, we are ambassadors of reconciliation, right? So 2 Corinthians tells us that we are ambassadors, right? The old is gone, the new has come. And I think that we need to take upon the responsibility of engaging in the practice of reconciliation, which means moving past theories and even theologies of reconciliation. I think people need to actually be impacted by it. And so when I was in South Africa doing my very first initial studies on reconciliation, we're in this small, like, shanty town, and this woman said to me, she said, "The gospel is rice." I thought, what do you mean by the gospel is rice? And then she explained herself, and she said, "You Americans are over here trying to help us, trying to take care of whatever it is, and you're going to leave. If you truly care about the people in this township, you'll provide rice, right? You'll literally provide something that creates nourishment in the body so we can continue on." And I think reconciliation is just that thing, but we need to start moving it beyond its theories and actual practices of reconciliation.
When you talk about anger and reconciliation, what's your response to people who say, "Hey, you're asking an awful lot to ask us to sit down with our oppressors and work on reconciliation. That hasn't worked before." What do you tell people who come with that kind of anger in their heart and skepticism that they should be part of a reconciliation effort when they are the oppressed?
Gotcha. That is a phenomenal question, and it's one that I get asked quite a bit. My first response to that is, how has reconciliation been defined to you, or how has it been played out beforehand? Because reconciliation without justice isn't reconciliation, right? And so as we're looking at what does it mean to truly be ambassadors of Christ, we're looking at the atonement. And so I think a lot of times people will say on either side, you point to a time in history when the two sides of BIPOC people and white people in this country were on good terms. We can go back to that. We've got no problem with that. But if you can pick a time, then that's what I want. And I think that's the wrong approach, because literally you've got American style slavery starting in 1619 with dispersed Africans. And since that time, we haven't been able to be reconciled. And so you can't say, let's go back to that form of a reconciliation. But if you say reconciliation is the atonement, which is the cross, we can always go back to that. Like, we can all go back to a point in time where we all need to be forgiven for something. And so for me, my definition of reconciliation includes justice, but it's a justice that points towards the cross, right? And so we may not find a point in time in human history to where people haven't been able to not get along, but we can point to the cross as being the one point in all of history where we can be redeemed.
You have said elsewhere that the oppressor is also oppressing himself or herself. Tell me a little bit about what happens to people who engage in oppressive tactics or who are racist in the world, even if they don't necessarily see that? How is that also a self-oppression?
Well, I think it is self-oppression. It takes time and energy to dislike someone. It takes time and energy to create new policies and procedures to keep yourself in a position of power. When you think about what it means, like, for anyone, think about what it means to be in love with someone, and how when you're truly in love with someone, that's work. But it isn't the idea of me working to control you or me working to keep you in line. Number one, I have to create policies to do so. And the second thing I have to do is I have to make sure that there's someone to enforce those policies. So there's always extra work. And again, it's the idea of being a prison guard in a prison in which you never leave. You can't leave the prisons that you create around racist structures and get to go home. You have to be there all the time, keeping mindful watch over this over the system of oppression.
I also want to ask you about law enforcement officers, because this is a, you know, your background is as a police officer, your background working with police officers. Cops have told us over the past year that their job has gotten harder. It weighs heavy on them as well. Tell me a little bit about your experience with talking with cops, about watching the killing of George Floyd, watching that police interaction, and then trying to watching, you know, the protests and the violence that came afterwards, and then trying to go out and figure out, what organization do I work for? How do I do my job? How do I connect with my community? We just got about a minute left. So what highlight can you give me that? And then hopefully people will tune in to your lecture for the rest of the story.
Gotcha. Great question. So as a police officer in Minnesota who works with cops, I have yet to meet one police officer that has seen the video that thought that's an okay thing. The cops that I've worked with are all like, that's not an appropriate thing to do to someone, right? It's bad tactics. He was already under control. And so, number one, we need to recognize that it was bad, and it was labeled as bad by police officers themselves. There's a reason why he's no longer a cop, and he's under trial. So that's that part right there. But I agree. Law enforcement is a very difficult task. In general, because right, wrong, or indifferent, you are being called to deal with someone else's problems. And so you are being called to deal with someone at their very worst, right? Domestics, robberies, homicides, you have to deal with this. So you're dealing with people that are at their worst. And so you're talking about humans enforcing laws over other humans who are in the worst possible position. So that alone is outlandishly difficult, but then you also add in the tension of a racialized society or people who shouldn't be in the job who are doing awful things. Unfortunately, we all have to carry the weight of our brothers and sisters who are in blue. But just because you have one bad cop doesn't mean that all cops are bad. And so we need to get out of that thinking also. So it isn't the idea. The same thing of being a clergy person, right? So one clergy.
I'm going to jump in here, Dr. Moore, because we're going to have to wrap up, and I just really want people to know so much more of this conversation Thursday night, 7 p.m. Central, Dakota Wesleyan's Stark Lecture. It's live streamed now, and it's free, dw.edu/live. Reverend Dr. Sean Moore, thank you so much for being here.
Gotcha. Thank you.